Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with James Moore, the author or co-author along with Wayne Slater of the best-selling book Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. We'll be talking about the departure of the architect Karl Rove and explore perhaps reasons that have not been stated for why he has departed and what his next role may be. We'll also speak with Li Tian, who's a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They are suing the AT&T in the context of the NSA wiretapping privacy lawsuit that's being heard here in federal court in San Francisco. And there's an expectation that this suit may lead to some understanding about the scope and nature of this vast secret NSA's secret wiretapping program that the president managed to get the Congress, the Democratic Congress, to extend for 6 months. So we'll look into that. And then we'll also speak with Dr. Robert Butler, who's the president and CEO of the International Longevity Center. He's a professor of geriatrics and adult development at the Brookdale Department of Geriatrics and Adult Development at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. He's a physician, gerontologist, psychiatrist, and he's also a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. And we're talking to him about the extraordinary revelation that came out in a study that was just released last week that the United States is 42nd in the world in longevity. Only 20 years ago, it was 11th. So we'll be looking into why Americans are living much shorter lifespans than other developed countries. Let's now begin with James Moore, the co-author, along with Wayne Slater, of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's also the author of Bush's War for Re-election. He's an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent. He's traveled extensively with every presidential campaign since 1976. Probably knows Karl Rove and George Bush better than most reporters. He's also the co-author, along with Wayne Slater, The Architect Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, which details Karl Rove's efforts to forge a long-term Republican political hegemony and the complete dismantling of the Democratic Party. James, do you have any, are you satisfied with the explanation that's been given, starting with, of course, the Wall Street Journal, soon to be Rupert Murdoch's Wall Street Journal, the official reasons for him leaving, which seem to be the kind of Republican mantra lately, where all of these Republican officials miss their families?
Well, I'll tell you, Ian, I don't think history has yet recorded rats swimming toward a sinking ship. So I think that, you know, there's some hopelessness here that everybody is acknowledging. But Rove, something that has not been said or reported was that Rove had actually told Bush on a phone call after the 2004 re-election that he wanted to leave then, and he planned on leaving. And Bush said, hey, wait a minute, you're the guy who is going to build the 30-year dynasty. You're sticking around at least through 2006, and I plan on you hanging around through 2008. And Rove, I'm told by people in the administration, acquiesced. And, of course, after the disaster of 2006, he simply couldn't leave with his tail between his legs, so he hung around and made another run, of course, at immigration, which was a miserable failure, as was Social Security. And I think Karl is doing what the only thing is that he can do, is to get away while the getting's good, and he's going to go and write a book, which I think will be his spin, his version, his first draft of history, and try to begin to convince historians that George W. Bush wasn't as bad as everybody says he was and all the a priori evidence says he is. And he'll probably, I don't know this for certain, but I think it's entirely possible that Karl will become part of some third-party 527 surrogate organization that does a number on Hillary Rodham Clinton. I think that that would bring him great joy.
Well, he appears to be already starting on that project. He was on Rush Limbaugh the other day trashing Hillary Clinton. And what was interesting about his conversation with his friend Limbaugh was that it had some, you know, I say this hesitatingly, Jim, because I know everybody throws around these Nazi references, but the Rove's attack on the intellectual elite, the cosmopolitans, the people that aren't in red state America, that hate Bush, was so reminiscent of the anti-intellectualism of Hitler's and Stalin's regime. It's just, I just find it chilling, but... you know, I don't think there's too many people that sort of read that into it. But
you realize, of course, that they've been saying these kinds of things since the beginning, as the reason that Bush was unacceptable at first was that he rejected the Harvard Yard intellectuals, and he rejected the whole idea of the East Coast educated person, even though when he needs to claim it, he says, well, you know, I've got a Yale degree and an MBA from Harvard. He is one of those people. He just managed to get the degree without learning anything, without becoming insightful or analytical or thoughtful. The whole idea behind that, of course, is to make those guys driving pickups out here in the flyover like Texas turn out in big numbers and say, yeah, the Republicans are our guys, and it's sort of anti-intellectual elitism, if there can be such a thing, and it's counterproductive. He's always divided people and has never ever thought of politics as the art of compromise, and he will do it until he draws his last breath, and he will continue to do harm as long as he does that.
But it seems, though, if you look at the Iowa straw poll, which was such a farce, essentially bought by Mitt Romney.
But it always has been, though,
yes,
as you know.
Of course,
Forbes did it, and everybody else buys it.
I understand it's always been that way, but this time around it was pretty sad and pretty unenthusiastic from all the reports that you get there from people on the ground. And the feeling is that even conservative columnists are saying, you know, what's happened to our party? You know, we've lost our way. You know, every one of our candidates has the Lord Jesus as his running mate. I'm quoting conservatives who are.
I think what's interesting, Ian, is that Carl set out to build this 30-year Republican dynasty, and the irony is that he has been so destructive and so divisive that, in fact, what he's done, he may have created a 30-year Democratic Party rule. Now, it's a little early to start saying these kinds of things, but the polls certainly indicate that the Republicans have no connection with the American public in a meaningful way at the moment, whether it's with policy on the war or domestically. And the Democrats, you know, if only as a default position, and for many of us that's what they are, is a default position, they're winning by wide margins. And if they begin to get a bit more of a spine and stand up to this president on the war and his rampant spending on this war, I think they're going to go a lot farther. But Carl's legacy may end up being a 30-year Democratic Party rule. Of course, his other legacy, and let me say this just quickly, I think two things that Carl has done that are tremendously bad for our country. One is that he has politicized the institutions of the government. He's turned them into tools for accumulating political power, whether that's the Department of Justice or even FEMA, for that matter. And that's sort of unprecedented. And the other thing is that Carl has changed the game. He's made it so that people are willing to say or do anything as long as it serves victory. And it used to be in our political process, if you lied and you got caught, there was a price to pay. And now lying is a tactic, and it's accepted. And Carl has completely destroyed the morality of our political process. And I think these are two things that it will take a while to recover from.
Well, indeed, it's a sort of political version of the Stockholm syndrome vis-a-vis the Democrats. They appear to be looking around for their Karl Rove rather than recognizing the destruction of the polity of this country through this sleaze. Just the full quote, by the way, it's in the New York Times Sunday. Frank Rich, from a young conservative commentator, Ryan Sager, writing in the New York Sun. The face of the Republican Party in Iowa is the face of a losing party, full of hatred towards immigrants, lust for government subsidies, and the demand that any Republican seeking the office of the presidency acknowledge that he's little more than Jesus Christ's running mate. So it seems to me that at the end of the day, Karl Rove succeeded. Instead of creating the decades-long Republican hegemony, he may have turned it into a Southern redoubt of the Christian fundamentalists.
Yeah, and what is it with us that we don't see this whole dangerous confluence of religion and politics? If anybody wants to see how screwed up that gets, all we have to do is look at Al-Qaeda. I mean, that's an extreme form, and in our country, extreme forms of religion, like extreme forms of Christianity, are people who go out and blow up abortion clinics in Jesus' name, which is exactly the opposite of what Jesus Christ would do if you believe in Jesus Christ. And the whole idea that religion gets involved in our political process, of course, is anathema to the founders of this country and the people who wrote our Constitution. And instead of the body politic rejecting it, they're sort of demanding on the right side that this happen. And I'm astonished that it's still that way. It seems to me that they would have seen the harm that does both politically and morally to the country.
But Jim Moore, I don't think there's any evidence that Rove himself is particularly pious. Certainly, his practices, the sleazing and sliming and swift boating, etc., are particularly Christian. But there's a lot of evidence that the president may well believe in all of this born again stuff. Because recently,
the president's near messianic, Ian. But in terms of Carl. Carl told his friend Bill Israel, who he taught at the University of Texas with, Bill had a conversation with him, and Bill is quoted in the second row book, The Architect. He told Carl, he asked Carl after a class one day at the University of Texas, he asked him about his faith and if he was a believer, and Carl said, "I wish I could be, but I simply cannot." And that is the intellectual response of many people. They admire faith, they wish they had it, but their intellect tells them that something else is happening. Now, when you look at religion and Karl Rove, you have to realize that religion is, as is every other sort of institution and dynamic in our country, it's a political tool. He used religion to motivate the fundamentalist Christians and the conservative base of the Republican Party to come out in just enough margin to elect a president. That's all Karl cares about, religion. And the other day, when he was doing his parting song with the president at the White House, having him invoke the name of the Almighty, to me, was one of his biggest moments of hypocrisy. Carl doesn't believe, and he never has, and it's not very likely he ever will. But as long as he thinks there is political value to pretending that he does, he will.
Well, that particular Rose Garden ceremony, the two actually were congratulating themselves on what fine, moral, upstanding people they are, and what decent. They kept referring back and forth to each other.
It was disturbing because in all of this talk of their families and this talk of, well, Carl gets to go be with Darby and Andrew at long last after serving his country all these years, and I'll be down the road behind you and not too long, and I'm going to be spending my time with my family. But you know what? Neither one of them at any time entertained the thought of the almost 4,000 Americans who died in that war and don't get to be with their families anymore, or the 140,000 plus who are separated from their families at the present time. They think only of their family and not of those families, and they never will. George Bush, he sleeps well at night. He thinks he's doing what's right, and God is guiding him. And if there's suffering going on, he doesn't feel good about it, but it isn't stopping him from doing what he's doing.
So the one thing that seems to be missed in the reporting of Karl Rove's departure has been how he has gone after voter suppression in terms of cutting down the Democratic vote and equally finding ways to maximize the Republican vote. And I'm astounded that any student of democracy or any American citizen who believes that politics shouldn't be a rigged casino, or to be appalled at the legacy of Karl Rove. So again, is this the institutionalization of cynicism?
Well, I think it is, and he's long believed in that. And if you saw what they did in South Carolina, where the people were getting, African Americans were getting phone calls on Election Day telling them not to vote if they had outstanding parking tickets or speeding tickets or if they were behind in child care payments, and this happened also in Ohio and South Carolina and all of the swing states, these recorded robocalls, and in Michigan they used a robocall that urged people to go out and vote to elect John Kerry because he was supporting gay marriage, and those robocalls were going to Republicans to motivate them. I mean, it's the central and tragic thing about Karl Rove's political ascension in this country is the proof that democracy is a system that can be gamed if you're smart enough. If you tell enough lies, if you throw enough money at the right spot at the right time, democracy isn't really a representative government. It's just a way of moving and manipulating people. And I think that that's something that we need to get a lot of big brains together to look at, to try to fix this problem, because this guy realized the flaws within our system and he has manipulated them to his ends.
Well, it seems to me that we're heading into an even more hideous election season. First of all, the last time around, Kerry and Bush spent, between the two of them, I think about close to $1.3 billion. This one coming up will probably top that. Furthermore, all of the states are clamoring over themselves to move their primaries forward. So we will probably end up knowing the nominees for the Republican and Democratic nominees as early as the second week in February of 08. So that will mean that the rest of the season there'll be no longer any retail politics, the face-to-face stuff that goes on in New Hampshire, etc. It will all be conducted on television. The media companies will get even richer, and the public will be impoverished by a sleazy campaign of destruction. So I see a huge role for Karl Rove starting as early as next February.
Well, you may be right. I don't know, he obviously doesn't take my phone calls anymore, and I don't know what his specific plans are beyond going to San Antonio and spending some time around his son who's going to college down there, and he has a house out in the Texas Hill Country. But for him to be involved in a hands-on sort of fervent Karl Rove kind of way would strike me as odd, because he has been, he's been the captain of the ship for a long time, and unless he is deciding to alter his vision of things, or if he really and truly believes, as he said in 06, that it was a much closer election than we thought, and we can still have our dynasty, and he's determined to achieve that out of the White House, that's entirely possible, because he had to leave Washington. He was radioactive, and his association with the Republicans was in 08 would hurt them, and he's got to, whatever he does, he has to do at a remove. And if the scenario plays out as you suggest, Ian, there is a role for him to play, and it'll be ugly, but the truth is, with all of the primaries out of the way, at least we'll be able to watch it more closely and keep a better eye on it and track the bad guys.
And just in closing, Jim Moore, you don't think he left town because another shoe is going to drop?
I think that's entirely possible. In fact, one of the political operatives that I talk to on a regular basis was insistent that the feds have an investigation ongoing on him and that they have not given up, and that there is an indictment possible regardless of the fact that he is getting presidential immunity.
And which one of the investigations would this be?
This would be a federal FBI investigation.
And it doesn't come out of the Valerie Plame thing.
It does not. It's something else.
Because he skated on that one.
Yes.
Because of Vivica Novak, the Time magazine reporter.
That was a very fortunate cocktail for Karl Rove.
Absolutely. And well, Jim, I think it's. You're going to stay on this case, right?
It seems to be my civic duty. About the only way I know how, other than paying taxes, to serve my country. So yes,
it's a rotten job, but somebody has to do
that's
it.
That's right.
Thanks a lot for joining us, Jim.
My pleasure, Ian.
Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. We're speaking then with James Moore, who's the co-author with Wayne Slater of the bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. He's also the author of Bush's War for Re-Election, an Emmy Award-winning television news correspondent from Texas. He's covered Karl Rove and George Bush longer than most reporters. And he's also the co-author with Wayne Slater of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power. I'm now speaking with Li Tien, who is a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, specializing in free speech law, including intersections with intellectual property law and privacy law. Before joining the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Li Tien was a sole practitioner specializing in the freedom of information litigation. Mr. Tien has published articles on children's sexuality and information technology and anonymity, surveillance, and the First Amendment status of publishing computer software. So you were also involved, I take it, intimately involved, Lee, with this AT&T/NSA wiretapping privacy lawsuit that's being heard in the federal court in San Francisco. This goes back, I think, to February of 2006, does it? It's been in the pipeline since then.
Well, that's right. We, after the New York Times reported in December of 2005 about the warrantless wiretapping by the NSA, a couple of lawsuits were filed early, and ours was one of the first three or four lawsuits to be filed. And it was special because, unlike the others, which were filed against the government or President Bush, ours was filed against AT&T, whom we strongly believe, to be assisting the NSA.
And how did that come about? Because you obviously had to have some evidence there of AT&T's involvement or complicity in working with the National Security Agency and, by extension, the White House. I take it there's a special room there in San Francisco?
Well, we certainly had strong reasons to believe AT&T was involved from the get-go because of a lot of the reporting around what the NSA had been doing for several years. But we were fortunate that a former AT&T employee, Mr. Mark Klein, came to us with evidence from AT&T that they had built a secret room in San Francisco that was controlled by the people who were cleared with the National Security Agency, and that was used to collect an enormous amount of electronic communications traffic. And so that evidence that Mr. Klein provided us has become one of the focal points of our litigation. And among other things, as you suggested, Ian, because it is an AT&T official document, and AT&T has said in court that it would like those documents returned to it, AT&T has effectively already authenticated or vouched for those documents, and so we feel it's quite established that their participation in the program is genuine.
And what role is the NSA or the White House playing in this lawsuit?
Well, again, a good question, because when we sued AT&T, we did not sue the government. But there is an important doctrine when it comes to national security areas called the state secrets privilege. And that gives the government the right to come into a lawsuit in which it wasn't sued or didn't sue anyone and assert that the information that is at issue in the case can't be disclosed for reasons of national security. This has probably come up most often in civil litigation between, say, companies who are complaining about a military contract and whether or not they've been paid properly, you know, as a subcontractor or something. But then, because the litigation might get into the details of something that they were doing for the Defense Department, then the government will come in and say, wait a minute, you can't do anything here because that would reveal something about our defensive or technological abilities. And similarly, that's what the government is trying to argue here, that the very nature of this case, the whole dispute about whether or not AT&T is assisting the government in a program of warrantless dragnet surveillance is litigable. They want to say that whole subject is a state secret. And if you know, followed any of the reporting on the Ninth Circuit argument we had in this case last week on Wednesday, you will know that the federal judges who heard our argument were very, very confused and skeptical as to why, you know, simply say denying that this had happened would be a state secret. But that's actually what's going on here. And I want to be very clear about this. They're saying that they can't say yes or no to a simple question because either answering yes or no would reveal some sort of secret information. And that's a very puzzling kind of claim.
It's a sort of another version of the 900-pound gorilla in the living room. Is it there or is it not there?
it's rather a catch-22, and it's difficult for the courts to wrap their heads around it. It's difficult for normal people to wrap their heads around it.
Right. Well, because there was a case back with the Howard Hughes Company, the Glomar Explorer, where a hugely secret U.S. intelligence effort to retrieve a sunken Soviet nuclear submarine, that was revealed via a labor dispute aboard the boat.
That's right. It's very much a form of glomarization, although, you know, glomarization is something that happens within the Freedom of Information Act process, and what's special about the state secrets privilege and the use in a situation like this is we're talking about a court, an independent branch of government, and one that is under, you know, the Constitution and under the Fourth Amendment, the one that actually sort of has is supposed to be exercising a check against the executive branch in the area of searches and seizures. And so, you know, as far as we're concerned, there's whatever you might be able to do within the context of an administrative agency Freedom of Information Act proceeding is a very, very different thing when the executive marches into federal court in a case where they weren't even sued and basically tries to stop that litigation from going forward.
Again, I'm speaking with Lee Tien, who's a senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They are involved in a lawsuit with AT&T and the National Security Agency on wiretapping privacy lawsuit that's being heard before the Ninth Circuit Federal Court in San Francisco. And obviously, there's reason for the public to be skeptical. Just recently, the House of Representatives, the Democratic-controlled House and Senate, essentially rolled over for President Bush under pressure to pass an extension of his wiretapping, or you know, basically extending the president's privilege to spy on American citizens without warrants and without any apparent oversight. They did that, I think, to some extent under pressure, where the White House has been floating for some time this notion that there's a huge intelligence gap that Al-Qaeda is exploiting, and the Homeland Security Secretary said he had a gut feeling that there'll be an attack over the summer. So I imagine a lot of these Congress people thought, my God, if I don't go along with the White House and if Al-Qaeda attacks over the summer, I'm going to be hung out to dry. Many people on the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, the people who know better than the average congressperson, said that they were being buffaloed, that the White House used the Director of National Intelligence as a political pawn to scare them even more. So it's a very ugly situation, frankly, out there. And what you're doing, I take it, Lee Tien, and the Electronic Freedom, Electronic Frontier Foundation are doing, is getting close to the notion that maybe that there's more than just wiretapping here. This is data mining.
Well, you know, a couple of things. First of all, yeah, our lawsuit does certainly talks about data mining as well as wiretapping or content interception communications. It also talks about the handover of communications records, which is something that USA Today reported on last year in May about how the NSA was also collecting not just what people were saying, but the historical records, perhaps going back for many years, of every person that they had placed a call to and every person who had called them, which is really sort of the same way that a credit history is a history of your entire, everything you've paid. This is a history of everything everyone you've communicated with, which we also believe has a strong privacy interest. But, you know, beyond that, this, you know, we're also tied in, or so we're going to be, we have potentially effects from the kinds of things that Congress is doing, right? The executive branch is essentially playing many chessboards simultaneously. You know, one chessboard is that in court, where the state secrets privilege is their main weapon. Another chessboard is in Congress, where they are sort of playing both the politics of fear around terrorism, as well as something much like the state secrets privilege, but they're also saying executive privilege, we can't tell you, et cetera, et cetera. One of the scary things about what they've been doing is simply that, as with the courts, they're trying to take out any possibility of oversight, combined congressional oversight or judicial oversight over what they're doing, which is really, and it's really remarkable that they've gotten as far as they have with it, considering how successful they've been in stonewalling Congress, which clearly has a right to know, as the body that has been legislating controls on surveillance ever since the 1960s and 70s, when so many abuses of government surveillance power were discovered, and these laws were responses to that abuse. But we see this cycle of abuse having risen again after September 11th. And, you know, one of our feelings, and I think a lot of the people that we talk to in Congress, is that, you know, regardless of what power that the executive branch claims that it needs, there should always be accountability and oversight for the exercise of that power. And one of the things about the current situation is that we discovered very late that even though the government had trumpeted in January that some of the disputed surveillance activities, like the so-called terrorist surveillance program, had now been authorized by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is the secret court that normally handles national surveillance wiretapping orders. What they didn't tell the public was that apparently a few months later, twice, two different judges of the court then turned around and said, well, that order that you got in January, way too broad. We can't approve that. It violates the law. And that's according to the press reports, and I don't have solid information about this either. That's why the Director of National Intelligence, Admiral McConnell, and their national security team got very, very excited over the last month and a half to try to get the Democrats to accept this very bad bill. But they were not willing to tell the public that the thing that they had so happily claimed back in January, that the courts had approved their wiretapping, they were not nearly as forthcoming with the news that, well, actually the court or other judges had changed their mind. And this is an example of one of the basic problems in this area. They talk about what they need. They talk about the threats from outside, but they're engaged in very, very, very selective disclosure of the facts. And so you and I, or even members of Congress, and possibly even the members of the Intelligence Committee, it's really unclear how full a record, how complete a picture they have, when the very same entity that controls all that information is very politically involved and self-interested and wants to manipulate the record in order to get its best result, and then tell you later, well, maybe that wasn't true, We've seen that pattern with this administration, and that makes it very difficult for, I think, for anyone objective on the outside to really trust anything they've been saying.
Well, isn't some of the FISA judges are threatening to go public, aren't they, that they're so concerned about the extent to which the White House has been unchecked for so long, going back to 9/11?
Well, you know, trying to figure out what FISA judges are thinking is sort of like maybe criminology back in the 60s. It's, you're reading a lot of tea leaves. They are, you know, they are federal judges, fully qualified federal judges, which means they take their duties of confidentiality very, very seriously. On the other hand, it's no secret that after September 11th, and the Patriot Act, when the administration was first sort of beginning and gearing up its assault on civil liberties, that the FISA court, that is, the lower court judges who actually do the day-to-day job of handling these kinds of wiretap applications, attempted to rebuff the Justice Department by saying that certain things, procedures that they had put into place post-Patriot were not lawful, and they got reversed by the even more shadowy Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, which is sort of the appellate court that sits on top of that. Now, that showed us somewhat of a schism, or at least not complete unanimity within the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And we've heard similar rumbles more recently, because the ACLU, bless their heart, came up with a very clever idea of petitioning or asking the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court if it would declassify and release the FISA court orders that I was talking about just a moment ago, the ones that rebuffed or narrowed any authorization the president might have gotten for surveillance back in January. And surprisingly to me, but I suppose one might say signaling exactly what you're pointing out, a sensitivity that may not have been there before, or at least a willingness to talk about it, then the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court actually ordered the Department of Justice to show cause, basically, to explain why these orders or parts of these orders could not be made public in order to inform the public. Now, I should say that the court has officially taken the position, as I understand it, that the ultimate decision is up to the Justice Department, but what they're doing here in this way is at least sort of putting the Justice Department in a position where they're going to actually have to make a sworn statement to the court about those reasons, which is very different from simply waving your hands in the air and making public statements about it. This is something that has a good deal more gravitas.
And since Li Tian, you're senior staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, involved in this lawsuit against AT&T, and by extension the National Security Agency. But prior to that, you were sole practitioner specializing in the Freedom of Information Act and in litigation vis-a-vis that. I've seen a number of friends of mine have had FBI files going back to the 50s with all this redacted black ink, etc. So today, a citizen who, you don't just because you're paranoid doesn't mean that somebody isn't following you. So if somebody today, a citizen sufficiently paranoid, thinking that the government is spying on them, if they went to the Freedom of Information Act, they'd get how far vis-a-vis what we're talking about here, about the extent to which this new program is operating?
Well, they're not likely to get very far. They're not certainly. Freedom of Information Act is a great tool, one that I used to specialize in using. We at EFF actually have a FOIA sort of specialty. It's called the Flag Project, where we've been, and one of the things we have been doing has been filing Freedom of Information Act requests and complaints to try to get at some of these underlying documents, just a sort of in parallel with what we've been doing in court. That hasn't been incredibly successful so far, although we are going to continue to chip away at it. But one of the things that I think that is important to remember about this, you mentioned, whether or not people are paranoid and, whether or not they're being spied upon. I think I want to be very clear about one thing, and that is that whereas the president, what they have been talking about for the most part is a program that is listening to or capturing international communications, and they are claiming that these are targeted captures, that they are focusing on a certain kinds of communications. Our case is, you know, includes not only that, but more broadly alleges that the government's essentially doing a dragnet, that is collecting a lot of communications willy-nilly, including domestic communications, and then sifting through them in some way we don't know about and honestly are not sure we really care about. And the reason we don't necessarily care about it from a legal perspective is because the law doesn't require you to show that anything is targeted. What the law does is says that, you know, phone companies, you're in a special position of being the ones that are carrying things. It's unlawful for you to make copies of stuff, to capture that stuff, and other than for the purpose of helping that communication go along its way. It's as though the post office were to make extra copies of every letter and then put them aside for the government to read. Your mail still goes through, but gee, there's another copy that can be reviewed, and that's what we're trying to make sure is not happening, and that's what we're trying to make sure the government is and AT&T are telling the truth about.
Well, just in closing, last week a group of constitutional lawyers interested in these issues met at the Justice Department, Bruce Fein being one of them, former Reagan administration Justice Department lawyer, and they met with the Justice Department's Assistant Attorney General for National Security, Ken Weinstein, and apparently it was a very, very angry meeting. And these lawyers got absolutely nowhere. The Justice Department lawyer claimed that the president's Article 2 powers trump any right of Congress to regulate the collection of foreign intelligence. And they basically got the back of the president's hand. So he basically says, and he very clearly says, that he is not in any way bound by any laws and anything that the Congress tries to assert.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Constitution was set up by people who happened to have anticipated Ronald Reagan's famous principle, trust but verify, and that's why we have a separation of powers. That's why we have both Congress and the courts supposedly checking the president. What this administration has been successful at doing, and to some extent Congress has been letting it do this, it has been it has been saying, well, just trust us, but we're not going to let you verify. That's really the role of courts in the system, has been to make sure that whether the spies are doing what they say they're doing, and making sure that any reasons and facts they have are valid. Similarly, Congress has that same kind of rule. Gee, you say there is a threat, tell us about it. You say you're doing this but not that, how do we know? I mean, those are the very simple kinds of questions, you know, common sense, you know, that need to be answered and that you need to have to be sure that the executive branch is in fact towing the line. But what the administration has been successfully fending off is any ability to actually know whether they're doing so. And so they keep saying, trust us, we would never do that, but at the same time, obviously we have to preserve our flexibility, which is why the judges in our case last week basically said, you know, what do you expect a court to do? Are we supposed to rubber stamp it? You're trying to have it both ways. You're trying to say that, oh, yes, we're asking for judicial approval, but at the same time saying that judicial approval has to be based on only what we say and you can't question what we say. So it was very obvious to the judges of this problem. It has been obvious, I think, to Congress that this is a problem. And these groups that met with the Justice Department, they see that same problem. But the question is, what do we do about it?
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Lee Tien.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Lee Tien, who's a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He is they're involved in a lawsuit against AT&T and the National Security Agency based up in San Francisco before the Ninth Circuit Court. And this lawsuit may, if they're successful, lead to some indication of the scope and nature of the TSP, the Terrorist Surveillance Program, the secret program that President Bush managed to get the Congress to extend for 6 more months. I'm now speaking with Dr. Robert Butler, who is the president and CEO of the International Longevity Center in the United States. He is a professor of geriatrics and adult development at the Brookdale Department of Geriatrics and Adult Development at Mount Sinai Medical Center. He's a physician, gerontologist, and psychiatrist, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and we've learned, of course, very recently, Dr. Robert Butler, the shocking news that the United States is 42nd in the world in terms of longevity, but only 20 years ago it was 11th, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what's happened in the intervening 20 years?
Well, a lot has happened. As you, as most people know, we have a very poor record in terms of health insurance. Out of 300 million Americans, 45 million, it is estimated, do not have health insurance. And furthermore, if they have it, they may not have full coverage. And furthermore, they may get denials when they make their claims. So the health insurance system is not very effective in the United States. Number two, we have a rising obesity, particularly in the last 20 years since this change occurred. We are probably now the heaviest nation in the world, unfortunately. We see old age diabetes, type 2 diabetes in 10-year-old children. It's really shameful. And this is related, of course, to both inactivity, sitting in front of a computer, sitting in front of the TV. In fact, we don't have good physical education programs in our public schools. Third is the racial disparities. An African American in Harlem doesn't live as long as a comparable man in Bangladesh. And finally, we have a very high infant mortality rate. That is, the deaths that occur within the first year after birth. We don't do as well, for example, as Taiwan, most of Europe, and Cuba.
Well, indeed, I believe also in terms of longevity, that now stands at 77.9 years.
Yes.
Jordan has an even better
Yes.
Which is considered something of a third world country.
Well, that's right. Jordan is better. Best of all is a little country called Andorra, which is in the Pyrenees. Singapore has a better life expectancy. I should point out that we have actually gained life expectancy. The whole world's been gaining life expectancy. It's just that we've fallen behind in terms of the amount of progress in longevity.
And when you talk about obesity, both in terms of children and adults, as a big factor in reducing the life expectancy, and you tied in diabetes, is this
yes.
to do with what I would refer to as corporate food, you know, Wonder Bread and Coca-Cola?
Yes, and the fast food restaurants, the McDonald's and so forth, where, you know, it's economical for people that don't have high incomes. You can feel hungry, and then you can be satisfied with a couple of hamburgers, a Whopper, French fries, and whatever. So we don't look enough at the economics of why people have become overweight. And as you point out, it is also related to the character of the types of foods that have been promoted, sugars, salts, all the kinds of things that do not help.
And when you mentioned, Dr. Butler, you mentioned Harlem, the life expectancy in Harlem. How much is that related to just the gang violence, the handgun proliferation, et cetera? Is that factored in? Is that?
Yes. As I say, probably number one is access to health care itself,
mm-hmm.
insurance mechanism, but also the fact that the infant mortality rate is much higher in our black community than it is in our general community. It's 13.7 deaths per 1,000 live births in the black community, whereas it's 6.8 deaths for every 1,000 live births in the white community. So, and then as you point out also, there is AIDS, there is gun violence, there is other factors that relate to low income.
And given that that we have this evidence that's pretty clear that so many people are uninsured, for, what is it, 45 million plus?
45 have, million.
Have no health insurance.
That's correct.
What, I mean, we've here in California, there's an attempt to bring about some kind of single-payer system, a legislative attempt to do it. How does it, just to get some evidence on the part of why we have so little coverage and our life expectancy is going down compared to, say, the French, I believe. They're pretty high up, aren't they, on that list?
Very high up.
Yeah. So would you say Andorra was the number one, the little...
Andorra's number one. Even Singapore beats us.
Right.
As you mentioned, Jordan does. Most of Europe does. Japan does.
Right.
New Zealand, Australia.
Where's France?
France is right up there near the top.
Near the top. So
yep.
They have a national health system. Is that is there a logical leap from that statistic to national health?
Or I'm afraid so. The you know, the United States is the only major industrial nation that does not have universal health insurance. However that might be managed, whether it's single payer, multiple payer, whatever the system might be, we don't provide universal coverage as these other countries do.
And is there any sense that you've had since you've published this report that that's a wake-up call? Because in many ways, I've often wondered why it is that we have put the insurance people in charge of health. Because it seems like, you know, it used to be the hospitals are run by the Catholic charities and others. And it astounds me that the insurance people have even got into this business, because surely they're more interested in, they make money off healthy people and sick people are a liability. So.
Well, that's sadly true. And out of every dollar that we think we're spending on health, perhaps 15 cents, which means 15%, or more, goes to advertising, to marketing, to administration, to claims adjustment, and to profits, so that we're not spending that full dollar on the provision of health care, because the health insurers don't provide the service of actual health care. They just are the mechanism by which people either get to pay for it or, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, they may be subject to denial.
So, without being guilty of too much hyperbole, are they not an unnecessary layer like the mafia?
Well, some of us would say so. Some of us, including me, would say that we would be better off if we... For example, Medicare, which is administered through the government, only spends 3% on administration. I mean, you do need some degree of administration. You have to have some way of recording claims and making the payments for those claims and so forth. But 3% is vastly different from 15%. And our Veterans Administration hospitals, which are a pretty good system, actually also does not have any insurance issue. They just directly take care of people.
Well, I hope that that this study that you've just released...
Well, I don't want to take credit for this study.
No.
The study come out of the work of the Census Bureau and of the Centers for Disease Control.
But, I mean, the message out there should be a wake-up call for American people, because, you know, we're constantly told how we're the best in the world in all kinds of categories, and the evidence is clearly indicating that we're actually heading in the wrong direction.
Well, if we're well-to-do, we certainly can get very good care.
Right.
And it's a very innovative system with many wonderful contributions from the world of surgery and medicine and from new pharmaceutical agents and so forth, so that there's no question but what we can highlight ourselves as a nation as being creative and productive scientifically. But on the other hand, as our Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, has pointed out, about 18,000 uninsured people, 18,000 uninsured people die prematurely every year. That's staggering.
And we have these bizarre cases where some people in health plans are being encouraged to go to India to have surgery done. It's cheaper to go off to India and have it done.
Right.
So I'm afraid we've run out of time, Dr. Robert Butler, but I thank you so much for joining us here.
My pleasure talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Dr. Robert Butler, who's the President and CEO of the International Longevity Center, and they just released a study last week that indicated that the United States is now 42nd in the world in terms of life expectancy, having gone down from 11th place just 20 years ago. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, and Lick Doan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org.